Now, it comes from one of my favorite scenes in the play, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe by Jane Wagner. Now, the main character of this play, if any of you have seen it, you might remember the main character is a woman named Trudy. She's a gentle and kind of wacky bag lady, and she finds herself in this scene, standing on the corner in New York City. She's waiting for these intergalactic space travelers that she's been teaching about human life, and she told them that she'd meet them there on this corner right around lunchtime. But she's confused because they're not there. She's wondering, should I have been more specific about around lunchtime? Do space travelers really know what that means? So there she is, standing by herself on the corner of Walk, Don't Walk, right where she told them she'd meet them. Now, she's a bit confused, but as she's standing there, she spreads a bit of her wisdom around. And she says, now, since I put reality on the back burner, my days are jam-packed and fun-filled. I go hang out around 7th Avenue, she says, and I love to do this old joke. I wait for some music-loving tourist to come out of one of the hotels on Central Park and go up to someone and ask, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And I sneak right up behind him and I yell, practice! And then, you know, the expression on people's faces is just priceless. I never could have done this stuff when I was in my right mind, she said. You know, I'd be worried that people would have thought I was crazy. When I think of all the fun that I missed, she says, I try not to be bitter. Now, I'm not here this morning to advocate that we lose our minds in quite the way that Trudy did, if we can help it. But I do think that our tight grip on our own over-individualized sense of reality, well, it can cause us a bit of trouble sometimes. Perhaps you know what I'm talking about. When we get to a place where all we can see are our bank accounts or the bills that we need to pay or our career trajectories, when we start to care too much about what other people think of us, when the spontaneity and the fun has slipped right out of our lives, when we get lost, when we let our values go by the wayside in favor of ease and comfort, when we declare, well, we do enough already, thanks. I couldn't possibly listen to another tale of suffering or oppression. I just can't let it into my heart. When we forget the innumerable blessings that we live with just by chance, it's then that I think that we need to pause there on the corner of Walk, Don't Walk with our friend Trudy and listen a little more closely. Reality, Trudy tells us, well, it's no more than a collective hunch, really. It's the leading cause of stress among those who cope with it. And this kind of reality that I choose to believe that Trudy is talking about, well, I think it's the kind of reality that keeps us mired in self and devoid of laughter. It's the kind that holds us back from doing what we can to make our own lives and the lives of others just a little bit better. And I think that this kind of reality, well, it's something that's worth trying to shake. So this morning, as we gather together for a moment here on the corner of Walk, Don't Walk, I invite us all to try shifting our perspective a bit. And I ask us to give this perspective shifting a try, not just because I do happen to trust that gentle and wacky bag lady from Jane Wagner's play, but also because I believe that there is something fundamentally wrong with our culture. And I believe that as fish swimming in this toxic and polluted water, we simply can't escape the effects of its poison. Our culture, you might have noticed, well, at times it seems to thrive on individualism. And more recently, our modern-day theologians are warning us that we are slipping into the grasp of something they call acedia. Described as a debilitating demon as far back as the 4th century by the desert monks, acedia plagued the faithful then and now, centuries later, modern theologians are pulling it back into this time and place. They're taking it up again and claiming that it is actually a predominant feature of our modern culture. The master preacher Fred Craddock describes the modern-day experience of acedia as something we might recognize as more like compassion fatigue. It's the ability to look at a starving child, he writes, a starving child with a swollen stomach and say, well, it's not my kid. It's the ability to see an old man sitting alone, clearly lonely among the pigeons in the park and walk by saying, well, it's not my dad. It's that capacity of the human spirit, he says, to look out upon the world and everything God made and say, I don't care. Now, simply understood, acedia is a lot like sloth, another word we don't hear very often. But I think it's not quite right to think of acedia as mere laziness. After all, I think it would be hard to claim laziness for most of us, right? In a culture where people are glorified when they get up early to do Pilates at dawn, when they work their Blackberries obsessively on the morning commute, when we multitask all day at the office, put a gourmet meal on the table at night after the kids have come home from French and fencing lessons, well, it's kind of hard to claim laziness, right? But the author, Wendy Wasserstein, asks us, are these hyper-scheduled, overactive individuals, are they really creating anything new? Are they guilty of passion in any way? Do they have a new vision for their families, for the community, for the world? When you achieve true slothdom, this author claims, she says that when we find ourselves slipping into the grasp of acedia, it's not that we are lazy, but it's rather that we've come to a place where we have no desire for the world to change, she says. And I think that maybe we get there when we become content with things just the way that they are, largely because they are okay for us. In her book titled Acedia and Me, the spiritual writer Kathleen Norris notes that acedia has taken root in our lives when we complacently measure the world by the scope of our own limited outlook. And sadly, she says, and I agree, that as we grow more reluctant to care about anything past our perceived needs, acedia asserts itself as a primary characteristic of our time. Now, I believe that Kathleen Norris is right when she claims that a self-centered approach to life has taken over in our culture so much of the time. And I also agree with those 4th century desert monks that acedia may in fact, be one of the most difficult thoughts to overcome. You see, I know without a doubt that when we find ourselves trapped within the isolating version of a false reality, we can become imprisoned in our own fears and desires. I know without a doubt that when we cannot see past our own perceived needs, we miss out not only on the pain and the suffering we're trying to avoid, but we miss out on the joy as well. And I know without a doubt that this can be a very lonely place, a place where it is oh too easy to lose ourselves, to lose our perspective, to lose our way. And when I think about folks losing their way, I cannot help but think about John Murray, founder of American Universalism. Now, I'm guessing that some of us probably already know this story. It's told often in our congregations. In the late 1700s, an illiterate but well-to-do farmer named Thomas Potter, well, he came to believe in the concept of universal salvation, and he decided to build a chapel right there on his land for the preacher that he just knew would arrive. I think that even though he couldn't possibly have seen Field of Dreams, he was subscribing to that same message, if you build it, they will come. But I'll tell you, after he had built this chapel, Thomas Potter waited and waited and waited. And while he faithfully waited for that preacher he knew would come, over 20 years passed. Now, finally, a preacher did arrive in the form of John Murray, a man who found himself at Potter's door when the ship that he had sailed on from England, well, it ran aground on a sandbar off the coast of New Jersey. John Murray crawled up there on the shore and ran into Thomas Potter, and we're told that Thomas Potter greeted him with this huge, warm welcome, saying, I have been waiting for you. Now, Thomas Potter, of course, was so excited that Murray had arrived, and he begged him to stay on and preach in his chapel. But Murray, you see, he had decided that he was never preaching again. It's part of why he decided to make this trip to the then New World, as he understood it, to give up ministry in all of its forms. But I'll tell you, Potter's faith moved Murray. It snuck in a little bit, and after a whole lot of pleading, John Murray agreed to a bit of a wager with Thomas Potter. You see, it was a Friday when he ran aground, and he said, well, if the ship is still stuck on Sunday, then I will preach in your pulpit. Well, Well, I can just imagine John Murray standing there in Potter's room looking out the window and praying so hard for that ship to move because he never did want to preach again. But the ship stayed stuck, and on Sunday morning, John Murray did indeed take up that pulpit. And from that moment forward, the story goes, John Murray preached the message of universal salvation and universal love and became known as one of the founders of American Universalism. Now, this is an amazing story. There's no doubt about it. Many have called it our one and only miracle story. And I think, well, it's surely a story full of wonder and possibility, no matter how you want to interpret it. But for me, this story, as it so often is told, well, it leaves out the telling of the real miracle that happened on those days. The miracle that happens not by chance or by providence. The miracle that happened then and continues to happen each and every day when we look for healing and redemption not from above, but from between. And I want to explain a little bit about what I mean this morning when I talk about that miracle that happens between us. But to do that, I have to start the story of John Murray back just a little bit further. You see, before John Murray ever arrived on our shores, back when he still lived in England, well, he had come to embrace universalist theology on his own through some reading that he'd done, and he decided that he would begin a career in the ministry. But few people joined his church, hardly anyone, really. And soon after this tremendous disappointment for Murray, well, his beloved wife fell ill, and try as he might to save her, she died, leaving him not only alone, but with doctor's bills he simply could not pay. Thrown into debtor's prison, our hero, John Murray, well, he naturally fell into a deep depression. And upon his release from prison, he declared that he was going to leave his old life behind. He was never, ever going to preach again, thank you very much. He was going to put aside his life's calling and travel to this new world. So as John Murray stumbled up on these shores, he arrived depressed and nearly broken. Acedia had taken hold of him, of our hero, and he understandably had lost the ability to care about anything beyond his own individual perceived needs. This man of great ideas, who had been battered and almost broken by the storms of loss and of life, well, he had come to a place where he was content just to survive, content to settle for being less than he dreamed he could be, content to let the cares of the world wash over him and leave him unaffected. He simply couldn't envision a brighter future for himself or for this world. He couldn't even summon up the energy to imagine it until he met his unlikely friend in faith, Thomas Potter, that is. And you see, this, for me, is exactly where the real miracle of the story occurs. It's the miracle that happens between us. Potter's embrace of John Murray for exactly who he was. His faith in John Murray's message and his reason for being. His encouragement and his gentle wagering. His unconditional love and support, well, it literally brought John Murray back to life. In so many ways, I believe that the restoration of John Murray's spirit by the love of Thomas Potter, this backstory to the so often told story for us, that is the real miracle. It's the miracle of what can happen between us when we open our hearts. It's a story of rebirth and salvation here on earth. And it's the kind of story that I think so many of us know in our own lives and in the lives of others. Because after all, who among us has never felt sad or broken? And who among us has never seen this kind of despair in others? Who among us has never known loneliness or isolation? And who among us has never lifted a hand to help, making a difference we simply couldn't have anticipated? Who among us has never received a phone call or a card or a word of encouragement at just the right moment? Who has never had someone believe in you just in the moment when you needed it the most? These miracles of connection grounded in love, they happen between us and they save us each and every day as we struggle with the wonder and the challenge of being human. So many worries, so many troubles and winds of life can knock us off balance. It takes fellow travelers on our journey and unlikely friends in faith to steady us and restore our hope, to call us back to our vision and our values, demanding that we loosen our grip on our fears and instead open up our hands to the possibilities that are right there before us. We need one another. Here in this religious community, we need one another to keep fresh before us the moments of our high resolve. We need one another to wash away the dust and grit of our journey. We need one another. If we are going to shake loose the acedia that has taken root in our culture and in some of our lives, that feeling of not caring, and then, at its worst, of not even caring that we don't care anymore. We need one another if we are going to shake loose from these bonds and remember that to which our lives are committed. Now, there are days, of course. There are always days when we will feel discouraged on our journey. Days when we will wonder if it is worth drawing together the little bit of energy that we have to make any effort at all. And it's on these days, I think, that we need one another more than ever. I know that I, for one, find inspiration in my church community. And I also find inspiration in the stories of so many others all around us. On the tough days, I like to remember the story of Greg Mortensen, the mountaineer and founder of the CAI, the Central Asia Institute, it's called. He's a man who repeatedly takes risks with his life to spread diplomacy and education one book at a time, building schools for both boys and girls in the heart of Pakistan and Afghanistan. His story is told in the book Three Cups of Tea. Some of you may have read it. And his tales, well, they take these wide and dangerous and climactic turns. But for me, the story I go back to over and over again in that book is a small and simple one. And given his world travels, well, it happened in the most unlikely of places, in the middle of a Mr. Sports store in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Greg Mortensen, you see, well, he was preparing to give one of his slideshows about the CAI. He was hoping to raise enough money to keep his struggling agency afloat and maybe even to build a few new schools in the spring. Now, Mortensen says that he hates public speaking, and he claimed that after 20 minutes of setting up chairs there in the middle of this Mr. Sports store, with employees buzzing all around him preparing for their after-Christmas sale, well, he found himself having set up over 200 folding chairs there in the middle of the store, and he was sweaty and tired and dejected and alone. See, despite his best efforts at publicity, his audience held exactly two people who had been dragged there by their manager when he noticed that nobody was in the audience. It was two employees. There had been numerous announcements, of course. Come see this amazing man who climbed K2. Come hear his great story. And still, no one came to fill those 200 chairs. Now, of course, Mortensen was unsure of what to do in that moment, but he decided to go ahead anyway. After all, he'd flown all the way in from Bozeman, Montana. He'd repaired his slide projector with duct tape, so why not fire it up and get going? So he began his presentation. He showed pictures of the mountain K2, which he knew the store employees were there to see, and he showed images of Fatima and Nargiz and all of their classmates smiling over their textbooks in the newly built Galturi Girls Refugee School. And as these images flashed across the screen, Mortensen says he noticed a professorial-looking middle-aged customer who was leaning around the corner. He was trying to unobtrusively study a display of multifunction digital watches. But Mortensen paused to smile at this man, and he remembers that the man stopped and took a seat. So Mortensen spoke for 30 minutes more. He was so buoyed by the fact that his audience had grown 50% in that one moment. And he shared his passion for education as he detailed the crushing poverty and the details of these children's lives, the things that they face each and every day. And he unveiled his plans to build new schools the following spring at the very edge of northern Pakistan along Afghanistan's border. Now, as the presentation ended, six eager hands applauded for him, and that small audience departed, leaving Mortensen to retrieve the 200 CAI newsletters that he had painstakingly put on each one of those folding chairs. And on the seat of the last chair in the last row, next to the display of digital watches, Mortensen found there an envelope torn from the back of one of the CAI newsletters he'd placed there. Inside was a personal check for $20,000. So with a pause and a smile on what was surely a low day for our intrepid mountaineer and school builder, he welcomed this professorial-looking middle-aged man into his audience and into his life's work. And in doing so, I believe, he saved not only both of them, but so many others who would benefit from the school that was built as well. Now, some days I know it is hard to believe that our small actions can matter. Some days it is hard to believe that others might share our vision that true change for us as individuals or as a community is really possible. But as spiritual people who are committed to aligning our lives with our values, it is up to us to do whatever we can to connect with our deepest selves, with one another, and to whatever it is that we consider holy. As spiritual people, we are called to act in love and in hope to create something new, to embrace the best vision we can imagine for ourselves and for our world community. When we reach out to one another, we cannot always know who we will help or if we're going to help anyone at all. And that's okay, because sometimes the actions that we take, they simply keep our own hearts from hardening with despair, and that is enough. Other times, our actions set into motion wheels we never could have foreseen. So whatever the outcome, whatever the result, it is always worth the risk to pause, as the poet Mary Oliver instructs us. It is worth the risk to pause when the goldfinches sing out in all of their raucous glory. It is worth the risk to pause, as the great preacher Fred Craddock says, when we see an image of a starving child with a swollen stomach. It is worth the risk to pause, to allow ourselves to feel and then to act. So as we stand here this morning on the corner of walk, don't walk together, may we allow ourselves to pause and to feel. May we leave this place renewed in spirit and strength of heart, reminded by the poet that it is a serious thing just to be alive on this fresh morning in this broken world. May we be challenged by her words, challenged by the possibility that this could be the moment that we come to understand what Rilke meant when he said, "You must change your life." Let us lean in to the power and the wisdom and the strength of one another and of this church community as we shake loose the bonds of our sometimes toxic culture, as we believe again and act as if we can and do make a difference in this world. May it be so, and amen.